I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Health Care and Veterans Affairs to order, and today is March 19th, 2009. I'm delighted to be here, especially because I'm going to open a public hearing on SCR 6, and I'm going to go down to the dais, so can I give someone the gavel? I will give you the gavel. And I would like to call David Vern Cook's son to the front also.
Mr. Chair, SCR 6 is memoriam for Vern Cook, 1925 to 2008.
Okay. Senator Lori Moniz Anderson.
Thank you, Senator Morissette. I'm Senator Lori Moniz Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdalewood Village, and Fairview. I brought forward SCR 6 in memory of Vern Cook, who was born in 1925 and he died in 2008. I knew Vern Cook quite well. He was such a strong Democrat, and he was actually also in the legislature, if you'll notice that. He served in the Oregon House of Representatives from 1957 through 1960, and then in the Oregon Senate from 1961 through 1980. So he was a part of this building for a very, very long time. He had a law office in Gresham, and he never retired. I swear, he never retired. He was always involved, always had his office, and I would always see him at meetings. And he really did a lot for this community for the state of Oregon. So I would like to introduce David. I'm not sure if he's prepared to say a few words or not. Introduce yourself.
I'm David Cook, Vern Cook's third son. I just want to say thank you. I appreciate this whole. My father loved the process, and he was such a big part of politics in Oregon. And the family really appreciates this whole. And that's all. You obviously have more pressing things to get to, so we do appreciate it, though. Thank you.
Thank you so much, David. And I believe there's a couple of people in the audience that want to testify also.
The sign-up sheet, I think, was Len Ray on the sign-up sheet?
Okay, and also John Powell.
John Powell.
And with that, I'll come back up to the front. Okay. Things. Yeah, and you can stay to listen to what the others have to say.
Good morning. I'm going to ignore you there. Come on up.
So John Powell and Len Ray, if he wants to come up too.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Powell, representing myself. I just wanted to speak briefly about Senator Cook. I was just a kid when I met him here in the Oregon Senate, and as you've been told, he had been in the building forever. And the picture that I'm handing out was a picture of a tense moment in the Revenue Committee that the Senator chaired. And I can't remember the joke, but something tipped both of us into uncontrollable laughter in a very tense situation. That's what I remember about Senator Cook. He laughed and he laughed and he laughed, and usually the brunt of his jokes was himself. He would love to do that. He was an intellectual who could speak without notes, remember statutes, write statutes by just leaning back in his chair, and if somebody, a scrivener, could take down the notes, he was just a remarkable drafter of statutory language. One, just before I got here, Vern had taken on Governor McCaul on a tax plan that the governor had proposed, and traveled the state, and former treasurer and attorney general and legislator Jim Redden told me that he was on the McCaul side of the tax plan, and they met in Albany to debate Vern versus Jim Redden. And he said, Vern stood up and said there are four or five kinds of arguments you should never pay attention to. You should not, the argument of authority, just because this comes from a governor doesn't make it a good thing. And he went through several of these things you shouldn't listen to, and then turned around and used every one of them in his arguments and got a standing ovation. And Redden said, I walked out of that meeting knowing we were dead in the water. Probably one time Vern stood up, as he had an occasion to do once in a while, and start speaking on a bill that wasn't before the body yet. It was going to be the next bill. So I went back to his desk, and it was, the bills were just scattered all over. Instead of being filed behind us, at least in those days, we had somebody file them so we could refer to them quickly. And I said, Vern, why don't you have somebody file these bills? And his response was, they're all the same. They just change the numbers every year. and he could remember what was in a bill, carry it, and answer questions and kind of recite what was in the bill verbatim. And he had a remarkable mind. And finally, I'll never forget the time he told me that he was considering running against Senator Mark Hatfield for the U.S. Senate. So he went to his good friend Glenn Otto, who at the time was in the House, and said, Glenn, I'm thinking about running against Mark Hatfield for the Senate. What do you think? And he said, Glenn didn't miss a beat. He says, I think you ought to do it, and you better make sure he's dead 10 days before the election, because he'd still beat you. Anyway, deep down in Vern Cook was a very kind and gentle man. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And who are? Which one is you?
Yeah.
My head's down.
Your head is down,
yeah,
in stitches.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else to testify on SCR 6? With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on SCR 6 and open a work session on SCR 6.
Madam Chair, I move SCR 6 to the Senate floor with a do adopt motion.
Senator Cruz moves SCR 6 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered, and I'll carry the bill. And thank you, David, so much for coming. And Mr. Shook will let you know when it will be on the floor so that you and hopefully your mother and maybe your other brother could be here also. All right. With that, I'll close the work session on SCR 6, and I'd like to open a public hearing on SB 749. Mr. Shook?
I find it here, 749. Madam Chair, Senate Bill 749 would require the Department of Human Services in the delivery of mental health and addiction services paid for with state funds to establish uniform practice standards to ensure compliance with contracts to provide those services, to post specific information on the department's website concerning these services, and to utilize the data reported to the department to monitor and report availability of these services throughout the state.
Okay. There are a lot of people that are neutral on the bill, and I'm not sure is it Bobby Green? Do you want to come first? Yeah. Good morning.
Chair Mona Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Bobby Green, and I'm the legislative liaison for the Association of Oregon Counties Community Mental Health Program. And AOC MHP is supportive of the Uniform Standards for the Provision of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and we welcome the opportunity to work with DHS to create performance measures and criteria for the development of quality assurance plans. As you know, DHS old data system that are incapable of providing real-time data about program and services. We would welcome a modern data system to ensure that accountable and transparent outcomes and results are available to the public. Data reporting requirements will be dependent upon local and state systems talking to each other. Getting to the nexus of some of the data we would all like to see is going to require investments that we all plan for together. Counties are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on new data systems as we prepare for the electronic medical records. One of our concerns is that our local system be compatible with whatever system the state decides to move to. We look forward to the department moving to a more consistent and transparent communication policy and posting the policy's directive, operating guidelines, contracts, utilization data, site reviews, and any other information for the good of the public. And let us know how we can be most helpful. Also, too, Chair Mon Anderson, Senator Carter asked us if we would submit an amendment to this bill, and I'll just read the text of it. It should be inserted on line F of the bill. It says, authorization for the department or the designee of the department to examine and audit the financial records of the mental health and addiction services contractor as the department deems necessary. That would be the amendment that would be submitted. You have it?
Yes. Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you. Right. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much.
And Chair, yes. I'd just like to say that I've known Bobby for a lot of years, and I would just want to say that Lane County's loss is the state of Oregon's gain, and I'm glad you're here.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate that.
All right. Thank you. All right. Madeline Olson, Sheila North.
You're over here. He's a good man.
Screwed.
I know.
That.
I know. Okay. I send him money. I wrote it for him. I wrote Larry for him. I did it right there.
He's Democrat, right?
I know.
So, just kidding. I'm wearing my lunch with my dyes over.
Scary. Is that the same one? No.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Madeline Olson, the Deputy Assistant Director for Addictions and Mental Health Services for the Department of Human Services, and I'm here this morning to testify on House Bill, or Senate Bill 749, excuse me. The department clearly supports the intent of 749. We are in agreement with many of the things that Mr. Green said. Certainly, the most transparency we can provide to taxpayers and the citizens of Oregon is essential. Accountability is something we strive for and know that we could do better and more of, and that's very critical. Certainly, some of the elements of the bill are absolutely critical, and there are a couple of the elements of the bill that we would like to see minorly tweaked. For example, instead of specifying a type of form, specify criteria for data that could be collected. Over time, if at some point we're able to gain the resources for a comprehensive new data system, having criteria for what's collected would allow us to work then with the counties that have already invested in electronic medical records and link those systems as opposed to requiring people to alter their systems to accommodate a particular structured form. But, of course, an undertaking of this magnitude doesn't come without a fiscal impact. And so from our perspective, we want very much to be able to work with the committee and other stakeholders to be able to accomplish this, but it simply cannot be done, particularly with the kind of oversight and enforcement criteria that would be necessary to assure the quality of the reporting of expenditures and other kinds of monetary information. We simply can't do that without additional resources. So we are supportive of the bill, but have that caveat that it's clearly not included in the governor's budget.
And I think the reason I brought this bill forward is we had such a problem with Cascadia, and there was just not, I feel, good oversight. And a lot of that maybe could have been solved if we had some of the elements of this bill in place. And I do realize that that there's no way that we are going to be having any new programs coming out of this legislature. Well, maybe one or two, but I doubt it, the way the economic forecast is. But hopefully there are elements in process that will prevent something like the relationship between the state and the county and Cascadia Health. Hopefully that we are learning from that and implementing things that will prevent that from happening.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, certainly We've learned a number of things from that situation, and one of the side learnings was really the amount of and the different type of talent that's needed to be able to know about the financial health of an organization. That takes a level of data collection and financial analytical ability that the state hasn't focused on, because probably more than 20, 25 years ago, through a very long negotiated agreement, the state moved away from line item budgets with the counties and into a different method of buying services under the guise of administrative simplification. And, you know, so over time, you move more towards an outcome-driven system, and in doing that in a scarce resource environment, you step away from elements of detailed monitoring, and that's rather the position we're in. Certainly many elements in the bill we are in the process of doing and have started doing in terms of posting information to the department's website, and we can continue all of those kinds of things that don't require additional resources.
Excellent. Yes, yeah, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would agree with Madeline on we don't want to put in statute the form, because clearly what we don't want to do in this is step on local communities who have developed good electronic data systems. And we want them to be able to continue their system and just have a way to merge the data. So I think that would be a good amendment.
Excellent. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Sheila.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sheila North, and I am here representing OPRA, the Oregon Prevention Education Recovery Association, and I am on the executive board. And I basically would like to support also Madeline Olson's testimony. OPRA's position on this bill is that it offers some important improvements to the system in that we do need some standardization. We think public information is essential. We think that administrative improvements and reform certainly are warranted. However, we have some concerns, and those concerns are mainly fiscal and timing. We believe that this time during the state's challenges financially and the organizations that would be forced to change forms and sort of halt systems that are currently in place. Many agencies and members of our association are implementing electronic medical records, and so we believe that the cost both to the department and the agencies would at this time be prohibitive. So we have some thoughts about it, however, and one is that we could recommend that AMH commit to achieving this goal within the next couple of years, and our association could work closely with AMH to see to that end. Thank you very much for allowing
Wonderful.
Me to testify.
And do you know that, have you been working with the Oregon, this isn't for Sheila, but for Madeline, with the Oregon Health Fund Board in how we can, in the mental health system, take advantage of whatever steps they're taking? Because I still feel we're still so siloed with mental health and physical health. And could you give some comments on the nexus?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're doing a number of things inside the department, and we'll begin to reach out to the Oregon Health Fund Board as we look at the federal stimulus package and that component that has to do with the electronic health records to see if there are opportunities that we can frame in a way that would allow the state to get an overarching system that could branch down and either be available to providers that don't have one or have an older one, and then have the right interfaces to connect with the existing systems. We haven't been able to determine what the opportunities are yet, but Dr. Goldberg has a group of people looking at that across the divisions. So we're looking at it with the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, and then we'll be looking and working outside of the department as well.
That's good to hear. Thank you so much. Further comments? All right. The last person to testify on this bill is Janet Ahrens.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and committee members. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We are very pleased to have your attention on this matter and as it's represented in the bill. We would love to see some standardization and some uniformity brought to our ability to be able to collect data and information and do reporting and tracking of activities in our programs. Our programs in the Alliance include children and youth who are in the mental health system, the DD system, juvenile justice, child welfare. We have runaway and homeless youth prevention programs, and youth with addiction issues. So we cut across quite a broad swath of programs and state agencies, and so we're always looking for opportunities for efficiencies and standardization, and are pleased to see the concept here today. We're a little bit concerned about having lists put in law, and you already spoke to this, Chair Mona Sanderson. We might be leaving important elements off. We might have included elements that have some feasibility issues attached to them. So we'd be more than happy to work with the committee or the department on putting together our best shots at being able to produce some standardization opportunities. But the lists in the bill is a little bit challenging. We're also I work on a number of different advisory committees within DHS, and there's a surprising amount of data and information currently available, and I wonder how broadly that information is disseminated or how much legislators know about the information and data that's currently available. Senate Bill 267 and the requirement for evidence-based practices has produced a great deal of data and information for us on the value of programs and outcomes, and evaluating them in terms of whether or not taxpayer dollars are well spent in those programs. And so it might be nice to be able to take a look at what existing data is already out there that you might be able to use and that we might be able to post so it's more available to the public. And I also considered the possibility of working with academia on such a project. Might be nice to bring in some external individuals to help us evaluate what data is critical and the best way to present it so that it's usable information.
Okay, further discussion? What I'd like to do, actually, I, as a chair, don't really intend to move this bill, but what I did wanted to have the conversation, and I would like to work on this during the interim, and so just to see if there's any way that we can start getting a little more transparency and uniformity, and maybe it's not necessary, but the only way I'm going to know about it is to have the players at the table letting me know what the grassroots people need and use, et cetera. So Madeline, put that on your list too. We'll probably during the interim work on that. Yeah.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you for bringing to light an issue that we've struggled with for years, it is a difficult one. This is an underfunded program compared to the need. We have a hodgepodge of programs across the state, county by county. Some of them are functioning at a pretty high level, others are not. There's different standards being applied. They're all trying to move to best practices. There's a lack of direction. It flows through counties. Should be more of a regional situation. There's areas such as Multnomah where county funds are mixed into the match. Others don't. There's areas like Roseburg, which have done a wonderful job integrating physical and mental health and drug addiction programs and mixed in with the hospital. But they've had their challenges, too. They've had to close their hospital beds. So there's some real difficulties here. And this discussion will not be lost in this session. It's going to be carried on starting next week in Ways and Means. I know you're on that now. Thank you very much. It's going to be a robust discussion starting next week. Not everybody in this room is going to be happy with that discussion. There will be those who will be opposed to the direction that discussion might go. But it's going to be a discussion. We have to get on the table, and I think there's room for all of us to work together on it. So thank you for bringing up a very important topic, and both one that needs to be brought forward at multiple levels of state government, and it is time for change.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 749, and I'll open an informational meeting from the Association of Mental
Health Program Directors.
Oh, you're just sitting there.
Chair Mona Sanderson, committee members, for the record, my name is Dr. Gina Nickel. I am the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And as we look at redesigning the healthcare system, I had a chance to look at the maturation process of the mental health and addiction system over the last 20 to 25 years. And I agree with Senator Bates. Some counties don't have it quite figured out. They do the best that they can. But we have some counties that really have done a great job of regionalizing, integrating, doing what we need to do. And I would say that as DHS wants to move towards a world-class organization, we have a couple examples of counties that have done the same thing. And with that, I'm going to bring them up to the table. Lane County is going to go first. I'll let them introduce themselves, and then we'll have Benton County. These are two fine examples of what we should be doing in Oregon. Thank you.
I'm Mary Gage. I'm a practitioner, and I'm the medical director of the Community Health Centers of Lane County. I'm going to talk just for a few minutes about the CHC. From my perspective, we are actually the FQHC, Federal Qualified Health Center. It also encompasses the mental health, and my two friends here will talk about mental health a little bit more. The Community Health Centers of Lane County came into being about 5 years ago, and with a health center in Springfield, and started from, you know, with no patients. Now we've served over, actually combined with mental health, over 13,000 patients in the last year. The Community Health Centers comprises about the main clinic in Springfield. Then we have several satellite clinics, two school-based health centers, one homeless youth shelter in Eugene, and then also a new site that we opened in October at Mental Health to help provide primary care to the clients of the mental health. That site, like I said, is our new flagship site and something that we're really excited about. We have also in the health center, we have a behavioral health specialist, a licensed professional counselor, who helps out with some of the mental health issues that come up in the primary care setting. And with the difficulty in getting access to mental health care, there's a lot of primary care issues that come up that involve mental health, and so we're really, it's been a great opportunity to have someone there to help us with that. What we've been trying to do in the last several months is integrate more with mental health, and part of that is opening up our primary care site at Mental Health. We've served, I don't know how many clients we've had there, but we've had the opportunity now to provide primary care there to help reduce morbidity for the clients there that we know mental health patients really, really suffer from much greater morbidity and mortality than the folks in general. So that's been a valuable asset to have that site there. One of the things that has come out of that is we're doing some clinical coordination meetings with mental health. We've started this within the last couple of months, and we meet monthly with several of the mental health practitioners to help us in primary care manage some of our more difficult mental health cases that we can't get access into mental health just yet. And we're hoping to increase access into mental health, and we're going to be expanding in the next year, have a site in Eugene, and hopefully we'll also have some mental health providers at our primary care sites. We actually hope to double in size in the next couple of years, which is pretty ambitious, but I think we can do it. We're going to try and start tracking outcome studies at our mental health site, and hopefully that will be give us some numbers in terms of things like reducing ER visits for those patients, tracking some of the numbers of healthcare that we can to see how we're improving the healthcare for those people. That's something that we are in works with. I wanted to just give
one little example of a patient, a couple of different clients who have been served at our primary health care site at mental health. One woman who, severely mentally ill, client of mental health for many years, and had been dismissed from every practice in Lane County, practically, or in the Eugene Springfield area. We had taken care of her for about a year at the primary, at the community health center, and we were at our wit's end. She called constantly, 7 times a day, very demanding, mental illness, and also some cognitive dysfunction, so just a very high care and really a problem for our health center. And we were at our wit's end, and we told LIPA, our patient care people, that we just couldn't handle her. And they begged us to keep her. And so what we did through this new site at Mental Health was we got her caseworker involved, who actually happens to be a nurse, and we have a nurse practitioner there, and we now have her going in monthly with the nurse practitioner. Her case coordinator, takes her triage questions. It's taken the burden off the health center, and it's really working out great. So we're kind of tracking fewer ER visits, fewer crisis moments, and I think that's just sort of in a nutshell, an example of how we really feel like we can improve the care of patients that mental health patients with primary care, and how we've kind of really been integrating this. So I'm going to turn this over to Michelle Farber now.
Good morning, and thank you for allowing us the opportunity to speak. I'd like to give you an ounce of background about me and why I think that's important in what I'm going to say. I'm Canadian. I grew up in Toronto. I went to medical school in Belgium, and I did my residency training in Cleveland, Ohio, 2 years in internal medicine, followed by 4 years in psychiatry. And I worked for approximately 8 to 9 years in the state of Ohio system, initially as an attending on a psychiatric unit, followed by medical director for two of the BHO's Behavioral Health Organization sites in Ohio. And during that time, throughout the evolution of my career, I've had the opportunity to kind of witness how different healthcare systems operate. And my father's a pediatrician, by the way, in Toronto, and he's now retired, but I worked in his office as his receptionist. Got to see how things worked. And I have to say that, I was pleasantly surprised to find that many of the myths that Canadians had promulgated about the American healthcare system weren't exactly true. Nevertheless, having both backgrounds in internal medicine and psychiatry has made me very sensitive to the dual needs that these clients and consumers have. And it's actually one of the things that drew me here. Working in the state of Ohio, they were doing a number of very progressive things. They were wellness-focused. They were recovery-focused. They were for minimization of impact on people's lives, and they were for client rights. Those are all good things, because the history of mental health, if you go back far enough, has a long history of abuses in those areas. And they were working very hard to destigmatize mental illness, to decriminalize the mentally ill, and so on. But the flip side was that I was also able to see systems where people don't talk to each other, where people don't cooperate. And by interfacing with some of the other systems, I can tell you that the frustrations ran pretty high in various sectors of mental health delivery, be it forensics, civil psychiatry, DD, addictions, county level, state level. We saw all this kind of stuff. So when I came and interviewed for a job in Eugene, I was looking for a change in lifestyle and, escape those nasty Cleveland winters and enjoy the mountains and the sea out here. But I actually was really impressed with Lane Care and with Lane County Behavioral Health because of the initiatives that they're taking or were already taking by the time I had interviewed back in March of 2008. And just yesterday we met together with Riverstone to talk about in both biological and non-biological markers and indices of wellness, recovery, and the eventual what goes with that is, you know, lesser utilization of services so that people are more stable and happy in the community. I have numerous patients, the client of which Dr. Gage spoke is actually my patient. I have numerous clients who have both physical and mental health needs, be it lung disease, obstructive sleep apnea, obesity-related conditions, some of which are related to medication use, some of which are not. I've reviewed a number of studies. In fact, the famous study that was done on the morbidity and mortality associated with mental health conditions was co-written by my then director of Ohio Department of Mental Health, Dr. Dale Svensson. So we were pretty close to that material, pretty close to that study, and reviewed it a lot. I have some other studies that I've shared with some people in the department that speak to the comorbidities and how they affect mental health and how they affect outcomes. I'd say that really where we're at right now is integration is what we're all about. We're all about wellness. We're all about recovery. And by wellness, I'm talking in a kind of a holistic sense, that we want people to have a sense of well-being, a sense of that they can recover from their conditions, that they can be active participants in the community, that they can have a voice when necessary, and that they can thrive. That's our goal. And I think that that is not achievable unless systems talk to each other and work very, very closely and utilize their expertise to help each other, how would I call it, synergistically, in the sense that our collaboration will lead to a greater outcome than it would be if we were just working independently. And I think that we're already headed that way. I'd encourage you to please think about these things that in some counties we're kind of there. It's still a work in progress, but we're well on our way. So please think about these things as you draft your plans for changes in the state of Oregon. I must confess that being new here, I just moved here in October, there's many, many things I don't know about the past and about other counties, but I can speak to what I've seen already, and I would invite anybody to come and please visit us, see our community, see our operation. The family practice and the physical health medicine that takes place in our office is right down the hall from me, and I speak with them every day. So I encourage you to come and see that, because we have put our efforts where they count. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And welcome to Oregon. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Doctor, we're going to hear a bill in a few minutes dealing with consumer fair, getting patients involved in making some choices. Is that something that you're already doing?
I'm not. Well, I think Bruce knows more about that. What I will say at this point is that I do support that.
Well, the patient integration, that they have some control over what's going on, and they can make some suggestions. You listen to them and help.
Yeah, it's kind of like
you're laughing.
Extension of informed consent, so to speak.
Yeah, I know. I guess we don't really practice the old patriarchal system of medicine anymore.
Well,
at least not in primary care.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what we're trying to do is institutionalize that and make it part of the system. Give some direction. So
support the concept.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Dr. Bruce Auble. I am the manager director of Lane Care, which is the Oregon Health Plan mental health organization in Lane County. And we are strongly in support of consumer involvement, empowerment, and partnerships and dialogue. So, yes, we are supportive and have a long history in Lane County of working with consumers and parents and family members. Just a very quick background. When the Oregon Health Plan was developed, Lane County decided that we would choose to be an the mental health organization. We wanted to do that for a couple of reasons. One of them was that we thought that we could maximize the resources going to treatment rather than into administrative and bureaucratic and benefit or any of those sorts of things. And we have held that value from the very beginning and implemented it. And we have in Lane County an extremely high penetration rate, which means that more people are getting into services, staying in services, and it's something like, you know, a 40% higher rate in Lane County than elsewhere. That also is reflective of, in Lane County, a high demand, interest in mental health treatment and alternatives and medications. The other base we had in Lane County is that mental health is not a standalone service. It's not independent of other supports, activities, physical health supports, child welfare, juvenile justice, probation and parole, senior and disabled services. And we have always looked for partnerships and integration opportunities where we could use the mental health funds and resources. We would like to get to the blended state where we can blend, but as you know, there are silos, and that becomes quite difficult. And there are rules that make that difficult. But still, there are opportunities, and we've created such programs as a 24/7 crisis response for children and family members having mental health challenges, services for seniors, a respite program for children, so we've consistently looked at the mental health system as supportive of community resources. And we look to do that in the future. We have very good relationships with the fully capitated health plan, LIPA. I'm on their advisory committees. They're on the Lane Care advisory committees. We have partnerships for some of the challenging patients that are difficult to be served adequately in either system. And I would like to add to the invitation by Michelle to invite you to come down, visit us, look at our programs, talk to the people who are making this work. One thing that I thought about driving up here, what is the key indicator or the key component of services that work well in physical health and mental health? I'm a big supporter of evidence-based practices. However, that's not what really makes the difference. What makes the difference is the relationship that the professional has with the consumer. And in terms of outcomes across the service system, I've also come to realize after many years as a bureaucrat that it's relationships that make the system work. The fact that I've been in Lane County for 20 years and know everyone, there's a level of trust and experience of working together, of interest in making the system work better. It is those relationships, when they're functional and when they work, that really helps the system to thrive. Thank you for letting us all speak today.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else? Yes, Senator Bates.
Could I ask a few questions? Yes. I want to let them finish first. Thank you for coming today. I have a couple questions. First, the case you talked about, you're a fully qualified health center, I'm guessing, from the way you've described yourself, with physical and mental health in the same building, I'm guessing. LIPA pushed back on that patient for you, though. LIPA didn't want to deal with someone who had that heavy a burden of mental health difficulty and pushed back to say, please keep this patient and do the best you can to help her with her difficulties and manage her. Tell me more about that relationship between LIPA and you on those very difficult cases, the cases that require a lot of resources to manage, keep them out of the emergency room, keep them out of being hospitalized, and the constant barrage of phone calls.
Well, we have several, and one of the LIPA has, I think because our clinic has been new and in the last several years we've been open and taking new patients, and so we got many of the really difficult LIPA patients, and so we've had to develop ways to really deal with them. And the latest, you know, really this collaborative with mental health has been invaluable. We have in our clinic one thing that is kind of a newer model is having a licensed professional counselor. So one of the things that she can do is take, for example, you know, when you've got a 15-minute visit and you've got someone who's very difficult and you can't get through it. I can funnel them off. She has a sort of an open schedule. It's sort of this warm handoff kind of model, and we can use her to help. And she can integrate more with mental health as well, because she's been working on her relationships with mental health over the last couple of years and has a very close relationship, and can help us get people in more efficiently and more quickly. So that's part of some of the things that help in terms of dealing with the more difficult patients, I think, because we're getting more facility with them, because we have, and now with our site at Mental Health, we have the site in Springfield and the site at Mental Health, where we have a nurse practitioner and a doctor basically alternating. Some of those patients we set up, we make a work plan. This patient we saw with her case manager, who happens to be a nurse, which is just a bonus, absolutely. And we met probably twice or three times around this, setting up this plan for her. She does have some medical issues as well. You know, it's not all mental health, so that's part of the... And it's been just worked out beautifully. Another thing that has been really, that we've been working with, it seems to me, and you can corroborate this, that many of our mental health patients also, you know, many have addiction issues and many have pain issues, and it's really difficult to manage. And another client of mental health who I had seen and would not do pain management with him because he was so out of control, we've now set him up with a nurse practitioner at mental health. He comes in weekly. He can get his medications at that mental health site. He can see her there for his medical issues and to manage his pain meds, and it's worked out beautifully. So it's just opened up many other resources for us. You know, it's really, really been nice for primary care.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
I hear. I know you guys are moving the system in the right direction, I think, but I'm so worried about the silos. We have LIPA, patients that might be involved in. You have a fully qualified health center they might be involved in. You have a mental health organization they might be involved in, and they're floating back and forth between this to a certain degree. And what you talked about was relationships between, and that's at least three entities right there. And you've got a hospital or two hospitals involved, probably. And we somehow have to bring this all together in one integrated system. And yours, and I've already heard Benton County's story, which is a good one. I mean it in a nice way, not the way it is. My inflection wasn't proper. A wonderful story. But I'm still concerned about that. And we're going to have more discussions in another committee about it also. But I want to learn today and hear from you. But I'm still concerned about patients floating between different organizations, getting lost between them. We haven't even talked about housing for these people, the systems they might get involved with as far as the judicial system is concerned. So it's very complex. And these people are really lost souls. They take a huge amount of effort and time to help. But if we don't, at your level, we deal with them in either the prison system or the mental health hospitals, and that's not the way to go. So I just want to express that as all to you. But I appreciate the work you're doing, because I think you're trying to move this thing in the right direction, try to get a truly integrated single system that these people can go through seamlessly and really be taken care of.
I think that's sort of the beauty of having the site at the mental health site, because so often they get lost just going down the road to the next clinic.
Absolutely.
You know? So they can actually go down from Michelle's office over to the nurse practitioner down the hallway, you know, and it really is, it's a really nice thing to have there.
Works very well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Senator Bates, one thing that you stimulate for me is this notion that what you want is that seamless system for the consumer.
Right.
So that they don't know all the background stuff. If LIPA and LeanCare are trying to figure out whose financial responsibility is the payment, that should not ever be at all visible to the consumer. And I think that that's what happens most of the time, you know, because the services are responding to the need. And, you know, I'm not sure that LIPA pushed back in a sense of not wanting the right services for those patients. They were pushing back and saying, you are the only provider left who will work with this person. Please keep them, because all of the other primary care physicians and those organizations have rejected that person because they're so challenging. So please keep that person. We'll pay you. We'll pay for what it takes. And then they'll contact Lane Care and say, you know, make sure this person gets the mental health services they need. Michelle is the psychiatrist. We wrap services around them. We have a funded transition team that helps those most challenging consumers find housing, make it in the community, have daily contacts. But the payment and the organization of that behind the scenes is not transparent to the user of the services.
Okay.
I would just do a follow-up comment. I agree completely. But to break those silos down financially, I think there may be a need for these organizations to actually come together as one. So when that patient enters the system, LIPO might be the overriding way of handling the finances, but we have specific places where you have already integrated physically in that spot, mental health, physical health, and the wraparound services those patients need. There might be other offices in the LIPO system that where people who don't have major medical and physical, mental and physical needs, where they would be going to. And I think you're moving in the right direction. I'm just not sure all the barriers are broken down behind the scenes yet. And we'd like to help you do that.
Okay. Great. All right. Thank you very much. Dr. Nickel, I don't have a list of who's supposed to come up next. So.
Benton County is next.
Okay, Benton County.
So, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Mitch Anderson. I'm the health director for Benton County, and we appreciate the opportunity to come and speak again about the innovations and the things we're doing in Benton County. I'm going to give kind of an overview of the direction we've been heading and the things we're doing, and then Commissioner Modrell and our medical director, Rob Nebaker, will talk some about their perspectives on where we're headed. I gave you quite a large packet. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. Most of it is background reading, but gave the packet to you so I could highlight a few things out of there. I know one of the issues that the committees have been concerned about is issues around outcomes, and what are we beginning to do when we talk about these changes about showing that some different things are happening about how we track the health care of individuals. So that packet gives some real concrete examples of that.
Packet. We don't have the packet in front of us.
Okay. Yeah. It's the Mitch Anderson one, yeah. I found it very challenging in coming before these committees to figure out what is the information that you want, and I kind of joke behind the scenes about the issue of I get the call to come up and explain the county system, but you have 5 minutes to do that. And, I always find myself leaving the committee thinking about all the things I should have said that I didn't say, and so I thought this time I'd provide a whole bunch of information that you can read at your leisure that will go through some of that. And as you think about the issues about regionalization, about reforming the financial system, I guess what I would say is to please keep in mind that much innovation is happening in different places within the current structures. And again, as you said, Senator Bates, the issue is how do you make that seamless for the patient by working the issues behind the scenes? And I feel like we're doing that very successfully. There's still challenges. There are still barriers that we could use some help surmounting. But I get a little concerned that in the process of driving a change or a reform that you end up kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater because as I've stated many, many times before, local smaller programs and county structures and things are the place where a lot of innovation can really happen, and what we're doing in terms of innovative practice should inform how you structure the system. And to get ahead of that the other way, where you just change the system without thinking through that, you may inadvertently damage some programs or damage some structures that were really helpful. In terms of just our integration, we're working to provide a full range of preventative and curative health services. That's a priority for us. We're in a situation where we, too, have a federally qualified health center, a little different than Lane County in that our health center is co-located with our whole community mental health and addictions program, our public health program, and environmental health program. We're in one building, and we try to look at it as a continuum of health care services, from person-centered primary care services all the way to the other end of it, the spectrum, population-based environmental health programs, and look very closely internally about how we integrate all of those together so that our citizens get the benefit of everything from that primary care all the way to preventative population-based things to keep them out of more expensive care. That effort's been going on for about 5 years now. We've met many, many challenges in it in terms of, as we look at those, the different barriers and how to seamlessly blend the funds and things. Focusing a whole lot on preventative services, focusing a lot on how we take what happens in the medical clinic, broaden that to what happens with our mental health and addictions patients. There's a lot of comorbid conditions that have not gotten a lot of attention. I think, as you've heard, a lot of times persons receiving mental health services or with very challenging behaviors tend to get moved out of medical practices and therefore don't get very good medical care. We have the system right in-house to manage all of that. When our physician in primary care has some trouble, needs a behavioral health consult, our psychiatrists are right down the hall. They go talk to them. They can come down to the exam room and work with the patient right there, and again, providing this seamless care. In terms of structures, we're actually involved. I highlighted three regional partnerships. We're a member of Accountable Behavioral Health Alliance, which is our mental health managed care organization. We're one of five counties involved in that. And that is an intergovernmental 190 agreement that formed that between the counties. And again, that was done for efficiency, that we have an administrative structure within ABHA that performs functions such as utilization management and management of those benefits in a manner that, as individual counties, we would have had to have done anyway. And so we're sharing one-fifth of that and actually getting some administrative gains from that. Another area that we've partnered is we call the Mid-Willamette Acute Care Region, and the state provides general funds to provide hospital care for uninsured persons with mental health conditions. What we've done is partnered as a seven-county Mid-Willamette region to manage those funds. We pool, while the funds come out to Marion County and Benton County, we actually pool those, and we actually use Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network, the MHO, to move those funds to service the administrative organization, since they're already there and we don't have to duplicate, again, the administrative structure. And then we have a regional council that manages those funds, looks at issues of hospital utilization, works very hard at building structures to avoid hospitalizations, and have been very successful at that. In fact, our organization has a reserve in case we get into trouble. We have continually exceeded our goals in terms of reducing utilization, and have then taken those funds and not only moved them back out into the community in terms of building respite type programs and things to further the efforts of keeping folks out of the hospital, but we have also used some of those funds to bring up the rates that we pay the hospital so that we approach closer to their Medicare costs, and thus have a very successful partnership with the hospitals where they're seeing us as helping them, and we're all working together to both keep people out of the hospital and make sure people get full cost reimbursement for the services they provide. The other example I put in the document, and it's actually on page 3 of your packet, was just a little example about the issue of administrative overhead. I think I have heard in many different meetings and rumblings around it that sometimes the legislature questions the viability of counties as treatment organizations, thinking that the administrative overhead may be excessive compared to private organizations. And I wanted to just give an example of that. If you look at this document where the bolded numbers are, what I did is take one of our programs, the adult mental health component of our budget, and looked at the year ending in June 30th of 2008, and our total revenues were $1.7 million, our total expenses a little over $2 million, which leaves a deficit. Well, if you know how county budgeting works, at least for us, you have to balance that budget, and we're fortunate that we have a county that very much supports health services, and they put a fair amount of county general fund into programs. So in this year, a little over $300,000 of county general revenue was provided to that program to balance it out for the year. Now, that's a sort of background. If you looked in at administrative allocation, we use a formula to allocate administrative costs to all of our programs, and that formula is in two parts. There's an internal allocation, which is specific to our health department, so across public health, mental health, environmental health, the health centers. Formula-based allocation goes to supporting those common services, client reception, billing, accounting, all of the different pieces of managing a facility. There's then what we would call an external allocation, because we're part of the county structure where you have human resources, payroll, county finance, the Board of Commissioners office, that is an allocation that goes across all county services at a percentage rate. And I for this particular program, I put those totals, the 400 and 100,000, so that again, that total administrative cost was the 530. But the thing that I think is often missed is that the county is actually paying a part of their own administrative overhead, in that they allocate that general fund. So in this example, they allocated $354,000 to our program. So they're in essence allocating out to us, which what we pay back to them in terms of that overhead. And so you subtract that out, and you get what's left is this $176,000 you see here, which is really the administrative charge of our services that's charged out to our other funding streams, so our state general fund and things like that. And that of the total is 8.6%. So when you look at it that way, really the overhead is quite reasonable, and in our case that allocation is inclusive of facility rental fees and everything else, so really that's the total package, so that ends up being a very good bargain in terms of what an overhead charge is. In terms of outcome data, again, I'll let you look at leisure through the documents that follow and just hit some high points. In that same 2008 year, in our mental health and addictions program, we served 1,579 individuals, over 20,000 services provided to them. Across all of our health services, including the federally qualified health centers, we served somewhere between 10 and 11,000 individuals, a very large number of folks getting services. We have in our MHO one of the highest penetration rates in our mental health services, about 9%. So we're getting a lot of folks in who need care. Folks who need crisis response get those services within about 3 hours of asking for them. We are beginning, as we look at integration, to look at this crossover between primary care and mental health care. And between June and November of 2008, 244 of our clients were seen in both our federally qualified health center and our mental health programs. So we're starting to see that blending where people are getting both services. It's one-stop shopping in our facility. And our medical side supports patients. We have a behavioral health component where there's behaviorists right in the medical offices, and support clients with self-management around difficult medication issues, diabetes management, depression, those kinds of things. And if more specialty mental health care is needed, again, right down the hall is our complete mental health program. alcohol and drug services, we have a very successful drug treatment court program since 2003. I've had 84 graduates of that. 74 of those graduates had no further felony or misdemeanor charges a year after completing that program. That program is also integrated with our health center. The treatment providers in the drug treatment court can schedule drug treatment court participants right into medical appointments so that they get full health care as well as addressing their addictions issues. Many of these folks have been on the street. They've not had good health care. We can provide that real preventative thing. We have our public health nurses right down there when they're getting drug treatment court treatment. They may come out of a group, and we have the nurses there and giving them flu shots this year. So we're doing everything that we can to integrate and build that support for folks. Children's services, we have a strong wraparound program tied with our health services as well. I think we have had no children in residential treatment in a year now. Those kids are in the community, they're at school, and they're out of trouble. And again, we've really focused on proactive wraparound services for them. So we're trying to put all these pieces together. We have what I would say is one of the best peer programs. Senator Morissette, you asked about peer services. We have on staff a peer wellness coordinator and a peer specialist who manages a workforce. We have between, I think, 10 or 12 employed peers who have received mental health services in the past, may still be receiving services, and they went through an 11-week training program that was developed by Megan Cahy, who's here in the room, who's our coordinator, and they provide peer support, going out and sitting with peers, helping them with shopping, helping them with anything they need pre-post hospitalization to support them cost effectively in the community, and we're continuing to build that. So a lot of different innovation going on. I've included in here we're using a depression inventory with our primary care docs, really looking at the comorbidity of depression with other medical conditions, and we've been really focusing now on our diabetic population, and I've included some documents in here you can look at that are where we're really screening folks for depression and then tracking follow-up with getting some services around that and whether they're diabetic or not. I've also included some just in general information about A1C levels, where we're, again, tracking that related to diabetes and moving that across our mental health population. We're also able to look at different blood levels and things for our mental health and addictions patients related to medical conditions. And again, Dr. Nebaker can talk some about that. So just a whole lot of stuff going on that we think is just on the cutting edge. And I'll kind of stop there. Again, there's a lot of material you can look at. And just in closing, quote, at the very back of this document, it's a draft form because I don't have the final yet from the state, but we were invited by AMH to be the local county site that the federal auditors looked at when they came and did AMH's state block grant review, and that was in June. And they came down and spent, I think, a couple days looking at our different programs in Benton County. And in their summary, I would just kind of follow up with a quote that they said, and what their comment was the complete embrace of an integrated approach to health is exemplary and at a level of maturity that is rare. And that whole document is in here, too, because they did a really fine summary of all our programs looking at fiscal things. So we feel like we're on the cutting edge. We really support reform. I sat on the Health Fund Board Delivery Committee and was real excited about the direction of that and how some of those reforms may help us to continue, but really want to encourage you to be very careful as you look at structural changes, not to damage some of this great innovation that's going on in Benton County. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have about 6 minutes left.
Okay, I'll try to be quick. So I'm Rob Nebaker. I'm a physician who did his training here at OHSU, and they really did a good job of stressing the need of integration. With Dr. Callen, we worked at the VA, actually was at the Vancouver branch where I worked side by side with the physicians there. So I actually saw them in a room adjacent. We shared the same chart room. So it was really nice. So from a very early age, I learned about the importance of integration. Certainly we're doing a great job at Benton County with our peer counselors. We have Jessie, who sits in our staff meetings. It's very satisfying to have her perspective on our care. Gives us a side that we haven't had previously. It's great to work with our primary care physicians, with our nurse practitioners. They're really a very, very talented group of people, and I'm literally down the hall. And what I've set up is so they have one time a week that they can schedule themselves. No mental health person can schedule in that time slot. It's only a primary care internist, family practice person. That's a full psychiatric eval. We do that. They can call me anytime. You know, I can come down to the clinic with them if need be. We do curbside consults, allow brief consults whenever they need it. It's really a very nice system. It's really been a great thing for us. You know, sit with somebody. The standard of care in psychiatry is everybody has to have a physical exam. Either you do it or you have their primary care physician do it. And so I'll talk to them. I'll say, of course, we got good docs in town. So I say, well, do you have a doctor? And they'll say, no. I say, do you want one? So that, and then I just, when I have them check out with my paperwork, they go down and then they can get a primary care physician. So. Okay. I know we don't have much time. Do you have any questions for me? Okay. Yeah, Mitch has done a really good job, so with Linda.
Hello. I'm Linda Madrell, Benton County Commissioner, and I also happen to have the honor of being the Association of Counties Presidents this year. And so I'm really pleased to have an opportunity to talk to you, Senator Morissette, you, Senator Cruz, and Madam Chair, Senator Bates, and I go back a ways. He has devoted a huge amount of time trying to change the health care system, and Benton County is honored to have Senator Frank Morris represent us here in the Senate. I had a procedure done yesterday, so my voice is a little bit scratchy. But I don't have a lot to say. What I do want to emphasize is that the counties are the laboratory for innovation. Often the scale is about right. Scale does matter. Too big is a problem, and too small is a problem. But bureaucracy goes along with size. And so that's something to keep in mind. And we function much like the states are supposed to function in terms of their relationship with the federal government, and that's being these laboratories, a place for innovation. However, the federal government has a real problem, and they don't trust the states. And when you take that on down the line, often the states are concerned with a trust issue in terms of the counties. But, you know, the real point, and this has come up before, has to do in terms of the people involved. Creativity is most likely to happen outside of the implementation of it, outside of a huge bureaucracy. I don't care if it's a private, whether it's IBM or whether it's Sherman County. It is difficult to get things implemented when you've got too big of an organization. It's the people. It's the people who are hired. The Dr. Nebuchers, the Mitch Andersons, these folks who are willing to undertake something new, who have vision, and who are supported by very good county commissioners. But other than that, it's the people and the relationships that they can put together with the other organizations that have complementary or like kinds of work. The federal government makes a mistake when they impose so much inflexibility in terms of funding silos and regulation that gets lost in the mist of time for whatever the purpose is. But usually it's instituted because a state or a couple of states have made egregious mistakes or have ignored the purpose of a program or the purpose of the funding. So I guess I would just urge the Oregon legislature, we're a small state, and so we have an opportunity to be a whole lot more flexible than the federal government. And our whole issue here is outcomes, not the organizational system so much. I've worked in integration systems. I know a little bit about health policy, so integration here is one thing, but I've seen DHS try to do integration in terms of other kinds of services. And, you know, you can put everybody in the same building, and that's one thing. Having the services actually integrated is a whole nother thing. And so it's the people that are charged with doing the delivery, their mindset, them being able to take up the vision of what integration means. Otherwise, you can have a large building with all these little silos in it with the same receptionist. And that's the end of the integration. So thanks very much for your time.
All right, any comments?
All right, thank you very much, very much. And thank you, Dr. Nickel, for providing this information to us.
Good.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on, this was an informational meeting. I will now, before we go forward, Senator Morse, would you like to introduce your guest?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Shadowing me today is Max Meyer from the Gilkey Middle School in Portland. Max is from Portland. And so I certainly appreciate your extending his privilege to sit with us on the dais this morning.
Excellent.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. Welcome. Hopefully this will be a good day for you. All right. I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 368. And Mr. Shook.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 368 actually does two things. One, establishes in the Department of Human Services the Office of Consumer Affairs to promote consumer-directed mental health services. And the second thing it does is establishes the Office of Ombudsman for Mental Health Consumers to provide services to consumers of mental health or addiction services.
Thank you very much. And Senator Morissette, this is his bill, and also I'd like to call up David Oakes and Drake. Safe?
You back. Well, I'm just going to be here for a minute, and then we can bring Becky up. Hi. Madam Chair, Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. Once again, we are hearing this bill. We heard it last session, probably the session before that, maybe the next session.
We just changed the numbers.
We are. Same song, third verse, different number. Okay, what I'm going to quote right now is the Department of Human Services Policy Ops and Package 202, which was put together for this program. The package helps Oregonians recover from mental illness and substance abuse with the assistance from their peers in natural community-based settings, and it embraces their ability to lead more independent lives in communities of their choosing. The package provides funds to establish the Addictions and Mental Health Office of Consumer Affairs with two peer leader positions, one for consumers of mental health services and one of those recovering from substance abuse disorders. The Office of Consumer Affairs outside of DHS will improve links between county programs and consumer-oriented service programs. The Office of Consumer Affairs and the Addictions and Mental Health Division will oversee the delivery of the peer-led recovery services. This was a policy option package put together by Mr. Nickel, and I hope we have money to fund it. And with that, I'll turn it over to the supporters of this program from Lane County. Thank you. Go first, Greg.
Sure. And it's okay. We wanted to bring up Becky Child, who's crucial on this.
Hi, my name, Madam Chairman. I think I can get all the protocols right. My name is Drake Eubank. I'm the operations coordinator for Safe Incorporated. which has the unique accomplishment of being the only full-service Medicaid provider run by peers in the United States of America, which has been a rather arduous and difficult thing. It's taken us about 11 years to get to this point. We've largely established this agency by ourselves and using only ourselves and those we could hire for technical support. We used our own funds and are largely in completely uncharted waters as far as integrating Medicaid with a flexible, choice-driven, and peer-centered model. It is our hope by the end of this year to have finished successfully synthesizing a fully Medicaid billable wraparound model for adults that integrates self-directed care, mental health service brokerages, and person-directed planning. That being said, I'd like to say the same thing about the political process since I've been up here enough times lobbying for this particular piece of legislation. I was one of the original people that helped try to design it to keep our consumer funds out of the grips of the budgeting process within the department. This is one way we saw of codifying in law something that would seem to get zeroed out and did get zeroed out in the end of 2002. We've been told that the press, the party, lobbyists, and the governor are the only things that actually drive action in the legislature, and we don't seem to be in any of those constituencies. I would like to make a small, hopefully humorous statement about group processes in this regard. Someone once told me that a giraffe is a zebra put together by a committee. An outcomes-based mental health system has a lot less giraffes in it. And a choice-based, peer-driven service system has a lot less giraffes than that. In fact, one feature that you might notice of a peer-driven system is that there are a lot less giraffes that are actually being called zebras. So, currently there is no venue, voice, or opportunity to include those receiving services in the administration and policy, and most importantly, the spending of money. Consistently over the last 3 years, consumers have brought you testimony, data, outcomes, and personal stories that have illustrated forward-looking and progressive perspectives on what actually works. And just as consistently, because we don't have political capital or public sympathy on our side, we've watched as the system produces more and larger and yet more expensive giraffes. That being said, one would like to consider, since they mentioned electronic medical records, about 50% of every mental health dollar goes towards administration. Only 50 cents of every dollar actually goes into direct services. Over half of the general fund budget, of close to now I guess about $300 million, is spent on about 600 or so state hospital patients, with the rest of the amount left to cover the entire mental health needs of the entire state of Oregon. In Lane County, where I am, more money is spent on Class 7 and 11 psychiatric drugs, which are unregulated and unexamined, because no one follows it or audits it, than the entire budget for the, you know, Lane Care was up here talking to you, that entire budget for their whole operation, for all their outpatient and inpatient services, is less than what they spend just on drugs in our county. There's not one regular regulator or analysis of this balancing of expenditures, though it has been demonstrated, for instance, by research, which is actually more recently coming out, that up to 85% of patients left on their own discontinue medications due to adverse and sometimes dangerous side effects. This distribution of resources, like the concept of having oil companies be in charge of the renewable energy agenda, has always seemed disproportionate, wasteful, and skewed to consumers. And yet, without enlightened interest, budgets for things including a mammoth hospital and increases in inpatient services tend to get funded rather than getting scrutiny for their effectiveness.
Drake, we have 11 people. Can you sum up a little bit?
My last thing is actually on integration, so I can actually step backwards, and it's about a paragraph. As for integration, I would like to caution from the consumer's perspective, rolling all of mental health services into essentially medical administration, as the more effective mental health services rendered by persons less than psychiatrists and nurse prescribers, i.e. clinicians, paraprofessionals, and peers, has a history of being essentially more effective to our population than many of the medical model of interventions. So that's all of it.
Thank you very much.
I almost finished on time.
Okay. Becky.
Good morning, Madam Chair, fellow committee members. My name is Becky Child, and I am President of Mental Health America of Oregon. I also have been involved with the creation of this bill from the beginning back in 2001, and prior to that was involved in the Olmstead work group to try and address community integration for people who have been institutionalized. Somebody asked me, well, what's the importance of this bill, given that we're cutting services? And I'll tell you that the importance of this bill is very simple. A mental health system without peer-delivered services is an incomplete system. There are people who respond to traditional mental health services perfectly okay, but there are a number of people who find peer support as necessary as oxygen to breathing. And while our state and many of the different counties throughout the state have been innovative, there's no systematic process for making sure that there's peer-delivered services available in every county. When we first started this process, there were four or five drop-in centers in Multnomah County. There are zero today. Other counties have been able to bring other services on board, peer services on board, which I'm ecstatic for. But what I continually hear from other people who use services is that they want a place where they can be amongst people who have shared, walked some of the same paths on their journey, who maybe are in a different place, but know what it's like to get sick and get better and move on in their life. The need for an ombudsman, we put that in the bill because a number of people who I've worked with and other people have worked with have had difficulty at times getting their grievances redressed through the mental health system. The grievance procedure is a cumbersome process. It often results in little satisfaction. And sometimes being able to talk to somebody in an ombudsman person might, I believe, address some of the lack of would facilitate that grievance process much easier. And it's not saying that there isn't a place for the grievance process, but sometimes being able to talk to somebody and having them help negotiate some of those bureaucratic matters is a much kinder process to people. In fact, I know a number of people who won't even complain because it's just not worth the energy they have to process a complaint. And so in closing, I just would like to say that this bill is important, and I realize that there is a fiscal impact, and there will be. It was in the governor's budget. We realize the economy has tanked. Well, it's not tanking anymore, but it's tanked. So with that, I'll close. Thanks.
Thank you, Becky. And Becky, thank you so much for what you've done. I've known you and your involvement in mental health issues for a long time, and I'm so glad that you're here.
I think there's enough for the shadows in here, too.
And while we're waiting, is it Sarana?
Saraya.
She is my Gilkey Middle School student with shadowing me.
Welcome, Saraya, and
Max.
We actually have a youth program at Mind Freedom, so go youth. So for the record, good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. I am David Oakes, Executive Director of Mind Freedom International, and there are 10 mental health consumer psychiatric survivors behind me waiting to speak, and allies like Bob Jundeff and so forth. So I want to keep this real brief. I'll just paraphrase this because I'm just really proud that folks are here, even though we know it's an extremely uphill battle. I'd especially encourage you to bring Megan up here, who has a legislative weekly committee on mental health that is championing this and did training for the testimony. So Mind Freedom is an independent nonprofit in Eugene, Oregon. I've been doing this work 33 years. I'm also on the board of, this has changed since the last session,
the
Oregon Consumer Survivor Coalition, OCSC. We had to fund it with an independent grant, Mackenzie River Gathering, but there's now a coalition of more than a dozen mental health consumer and psychiatric survivor organizations, and I'm on that board, and they strongly support this bill, too. So I'd also like to thank Senator Morissette, who really has had a long-term commitment to hear the voice of some of the most marginalized and disempowered citizens in Lane County. And that's a real measure of citizenship when every citizen is really welcome. So thanks, Senator, for that. You know, every day we're obviously hearing in the media that there's a crisis, an enormous crisis, cutbacks, citizens have greater needs than ever. And everyone agrees this crisis is harmful to mental health clients. So therefore, it is more important than ever this time to support and hear the voice of these mental health clients, to get feedback about policy for mental health care, and to take advocacy when there are problems. So I know that this is a little bit like Don Quixote in this session trying to pass this bill, and it unfortunately did not get into Governor Kulongowski's budget. It came this close. I talked to Bruce Goldberg at Dave Romprey's memorial, and he told me it would get in there. So unfortunately, it's sad. But I would really encourage you to push this, especially at Ways and Means, when I hope you pass this, because in the 1980s and 1990s, Oregon was a pioneer in the consumer survivor voice. Oregon helped create mental health consumer organizations, held statewide conferences, started drop-in centers. But in January 2003, more than 6 years ago, that month is infamous in our community because that is the month that all 100% of funding for statewide voice of mental health consumers and psychiatric survivors ended. Now, I know there's little technical assistance here and there and so forth, but basically it's no longer a line item for 6 years. And by coincidence, that's when the governor took office, and it's just continued ever since. So today, Oregon is one of the few USA states with no state funding for the statewide voice of mental health clients. No newsletter, no consumer funding, no conference, no technical assistance. We're part of a national coalition of 30 states that have statewide organizations. I think we're the only one that is not funded in some way by the state to have support for that. But at the same time, we're funding $500 million for new institutions. The debate is over about building these new institutions. Wherever you stand on building the new institutions, $500 million was found to build the new institutions, and no funding was found for the statewide voice of mental health clients in the last session. Millions of dollars were gained by the disposal of the damaged state hospital land. However, despite its history of disempowerment of clients, none of that money has so far been directed to the statewide voice of mental health clients. You know about several lawsuits this last year, that the Oregon Attorney General was part of several lawsuits about psychiatric drugging, resulting in Oregon getting several $1 million because of problems with inappropriate psychiatric drugging. So far, none of that settlement money has gone to the voice of mental health clients. So this is one of the most disempowered groups around. Last session, we did have a success. We passed a bill that 20% of all commissions and committees advising on mental health had to be mental health consumers. That was a real victory. But that's an unfunded mandate. In order to staff those committees and commissions, to train people, to give them the technical assistance, you need to have some kind of help. And an example of this is that 6 years ago, the governor created a stakeholder committee to advise him about building those new institutions. So there's a stakeholder committee to advise them. They have a mandate to have consumer representation. They have three empty slots for the mental health consumers that are they don't have to advise them on the stakeholder committee. So even the stakeholder committee for the new institutions does not have mental health consumer representation on it. And I found out that my friend here, Bob Joondef, was being counted by the stakeholder committee as a mental health consumer, I guess an honorary mental health consumer, in order to make quota. Bob has politely informed me he was honored, you know, to be called one of us. But no, he's not a mental health consumer, and so now they have three empty. I'm just giving this as an example, and there's more in here, where there's no number you can call to reach the mental health consumer.
Can
community.
You sum up?
Yeah, I'm on the end here, and I appreciated hearing Bruce Abel and company earlier discussing Lane County, because we have a saying here, nothing about us without us. And so 368 does not seek substantial resources. It does send a signal that Oregon services will begin and end with the customers themselves. So we give SB 368 our highest recommendations. Thanks.
Thank you very much, very much. Megan Cahy and Jesse Willis and Helen Laura.
Yeah, Madam Chair, while they're coming up, I'd like to welcome my Gilkey student, Mariah. So,
welcome. We're glad that you're here.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Megan Cahy, and I'm grateful for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 368. I'm testifying on behalf of Mental Health America of Oregon, which I'm the vice president of. I have much experience as a mental health consumer. I've been hospitalized over 100 times and have received electroconvulsive shock therapy, many rounds of it, and insulin coma therapy. I've been in seclusion rooms and four-point restraints many times. I've tried to end my life and ended up finding the path to life and wellness. And I'm very happy and grateful today to be working to provide advocacy and health services and wellness services to my peers. And that's very gratifying to me. And I'm very happy to be up here testifying for this bill for the second time in a couple of years. I wish it would have won a place in our legislative life a couple of years ago, but I'm back. So, first off, this bill is very, very important for mental health consumers, and it's important for all Oregonians, because many Oregonians are mental health consumers. Part of what this bill has to do with is provides an ombudsman or ombudsperson. And one of the things I'm doing is working for reform for Oregon State Hospital. And, of course, the ombudsperson would serve any mental health consumer that had complaints. But I'm especially concerned about the persons that are incarcerated at the Oregon State Hospital. And as you all know, the Department of Justice has conducted an investigation of a very critical investigation of the Oregon State Hospital. And I believe that if the residents of the Oregon State Hospital had an ombudsperson associated with this office where they could make fair and have an unbiased representative for the due process of their complaints, that would aid the present investigation by the Department of Justice. So I think that would be good for our state and for the case that's currently up with the Department of Justice. So that would not only help mental health consumers, but that would be good for our state and for the state's current judicial or correctional, whatever situation you might say that we're in. Peer services. This Office of Consumer Affairs would help. Right now, the state is undergoing some changes with becoming to have certification for peer-delivered service providers. Richard Harris, who is the acting director of Addictions and Mental Health, has passed some judgments which will give us certification for peer-delivered service providers. And we need an Office of Consumer Affairs to help monitor the peer delivered service functions. We really need this. We also need this office to help us be ensured that we have consumer directed services in our agencies and organizations. Those are two things that are very important. That question came up earlier when Lane County was talking about their services. Senator Morissette, you were asking, I believe, do you have consumer or person-directed services? And person-directed services are very important. And this bill would help ensure that person-directed services were the state of what the services were across the land.
Okay, thank you, Megan. Can you sum up in another sentence or so?
I would like to say that we are dying 25 to 38 years earlier than the general population. This bill would be a first step in helping change that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Megan, very much. And thank you for your involvement in this process, in this legislative process.
Hi, my name is Jesse Willis, and I'm from Benton County. Chair Lourdes Anderson and members of the committee, I want to tell you how much I appreciate the chance to testify in support of Senate Bill 368. I work as a peer wellness specialist with a community health organization, and I'm also a consumer and survivor of bipolar disorder. This bill is a good idea, both in terms of helping people with mental illness, but it also can save the state some money, and I'd like to explain why. Senate Bill 368 gives consumers a voice in their own treatment and recovery. It allows them to have an advocate to help them with issues that may arise by providing an ombudsman. It also supports peer-delivered services, which is a key part of the recovery process. Peer services gives consumers support in a way that is different from clinicians. The peer counselors help consumers by being someone who has gone through similar experiences and diagnosis. This unique service is crucial in a person's recovery and can help keep that person from going to the hospital. Peer-delivered services are greatly less expensive than traditional treatments, and this saves the state money that would be otherwise be spent on hospital expenses. I have witnessed this through my work as a peer wellness specialist. This bill would support peer counselors by providing certification for counseling. Living with bipolar, I have been hospitalized on several occasions, and actually, Senator Cruz, I was hospitalized at the Roseburg Hospital, and I was probably one of the last groups of people to be hospitalized before they closed the beds. I felt so alone and empty when I was in the hospital, and those experiences were really a point in my life where I hit rock bottom. I felt that there was no one to help me. But working as a peer wellness specialist, I see just how important these services are. And I feel that if I just had a person to talk to, I may have avoided going to the hospital. So please join me in support of Senate Bill 368. It is crucial to provide this type of support to the mental health community. And thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Jesse, so much.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairwoman and committee, for hearing our testimony. My name is Helen Lahr, and I live in Staten. I want to welcome the youth here today, too. I'm testifying today to describe the benefits of passing SB 368 for an Office of Consumer Affairs at the state level for Oregon. I'm a new resident of Oregon after moving here a year ago to take the job of Consumer Affairs Specialist at Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network, which is the managed health care organization that serves mental health and addiction programs for Medicaid recipients in the five counties of Lynn, Marion, Tillamook, Polk, and Yamhill. I'm also a consumer survivor who has experienced various degrees of difficulty with mental health for almost 40 years. In the past year, I've been fortunate to be part of BCN and have been impressed with the incredible consumer advocacy that I found at various committees and work groups. I believe that because of this emphasis and involvement, BCN is a strong organization and extremely recovery conscious, implementing many ideas over the years that advocates have helped to create and develop. This includes funding for 6 peer-run organizations throughout the region. The advantage of funding a consumer affairs specialist position at BCN has been not only to maintain the infrastructure of these peer-run organizations, but also helps to ensure the advocacy piece that is very powerful and helpful in maintaining the organization's commitment to recovery and empowerment of the people we serve. This is the crux of the statewide positions as well. In order to have progress within any system of treatment and or recovery, it is imperative to have those who are affected by and receiving services from the system as part of the process and included in any policy change or discussion. It is well documented that recovery is not only possible for mental health recipients, but can only happen when we are included in the decisions and choices that affect our lives. Peer support is a key component of recovery for many people. The state office would help Oregon not only to maintain the peer-run organizations that exist presently, but would help to find ways to create more peer-run activities in the future as a way not only to augment and improve the system that exists today, but to encourage and promote recovery. It would also help administrators understand some of the gaps in service that exist and bring innovative, cost-effective solutions to the table. I cannot overstress the importance and value of direct feedback from clients' consumer survivor perspective enough. The inclusion of this perspective is fundamental to promoting recovery in mental health. By funding the positions proposed in SB 368, Oregon would be making a commitment to and placing value on its citizens who are affected by mental health difficulties, which includes recipients of services as well as our family members and friends. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming.
Madam really Chair. Appreciate
it. Yes, Senator Morrison.
I often wonder what would have been different if Senator Gordley's son, who was in the mental hospital, had an ombudsperson to assist him. We heard his testimony last year in the subcommittee on Ways and Means, and it was pretty dramatic and traumatic as well. So I think we need the ombudsperson role.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Mike Adelman, and is it Cruada White? And Tom Wilson.
Do you want to introduce your guests?
That's yours.
It is. I didn't know anything about it.
Aaron brought her in.
Go ahead.
Good morning. Chair Mona Sanderson and the members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 368. My name is Mike Adelman, and I live in Salem. I'm diagnosed with bipolar disorder and have been hospitalized, at least 10 times, beginning at age 15 for psychiatric reasons. In October 2003, I was in jail and did not receive proper medical attention. I requested twice to be placed on an antipsychotic, and my requests were not answered. I turned over the medical kites, they call them, to my attorney for safekeeping, and I subsequently lost them. I was so sick that upon my release, I was transported to Salem Hospital, where I refused treatment because they made comments about my psych file being so thick within my earshot. 1 week and three police contacts later, I attempted to light a warming fire using charcoal briquettes and lighter fluid inside my garage as my roommate had locked me out of the house. The garage caught fire and I was charged with arson one. It should be mentioned that I had a doctor appointment the same day the crime occurred to be placed on the correct medication. Had I been aware of the community resources available, such as the Psychiatric Crisis Center, this tragedy would not have occurred. I chose the guilty except for insanity plea for my defense, since I was psychotic at the time of the commission of my crime. I'm currently under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board for the mandatory allowable time period of 20 years. I spent about a month in jail after the offense and then another 16 and a half months in Oregon State Hospital at the taxpayers' expense. That was December of 03 to March of 05. And I currently live primarily on Social Security disability. I believe that proper medical attention while in jail would have prevented this offense from occurring. I further believe that an ombudsman would have been able to lessen the impacts these events have had and are having on myself, my family, and the taxpaying public. I've been involved with the consumer empowerment team. I was president and vice president at various times. They operated out of Friendship House, which is was a Marion County entity. It's been split up now and supplemented by some other programs. I've also been active in the Oregon Consumer Survivor Council and in law enforcement training. And peer and support services have enabled me to rebuild my life to a large degree. They were especially important during the months immediately following my release from the hospital, and I continue to use them frequently. They provide such resources as meeting facilities, computer labs, and socialization opportunities. These are the reasons I am in support of Senate Bill 368, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you so much. It takes a lot of courage to come and tell a story. Your story, so we appreciate that. It's important for us to hear that, though. Thank you. Oh, and I'd also like to introduce Christina. Are you shadowing? Who are you shadowing?
Senator Bates.
Senator Bates, that's what I thought.
I was last to know. I look forward to work with you today.
Okay. All right.
Well, good morning, Chair Senator Moines Anderson. And rest of the committee. My name is Crusita White.
Crusita.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
I got your name right this year, too. I'm here to support Senate Bill 368 in the Office of Consumer Affairs for numerous reasons. One, my personal story is I've been a consumer survivor. I got diagnosed approximately 5 years ago. And I've been very fortunate after being diagnosed that I got referred to a lot of mental health and addictions, DHS, consumer-run meetings and councils, also services that were available in the community with consumer-run organizations. I have a personal interest in this bill in the sense that also I have a mother who is now 81 years old, and she's been a consumer survivor for years. But she's very high-functioning. She's been very highly educated. She has a doctor of education and counseling and served with Salem-Keizer District for over 27 years prior to retiring. And what has happened recently is the last 2 years, or a little over a year, she asked for some assistance. She married a husband that was not a consumer, and he's very abusive. She asked protective services for assistance because he was abusing her physically, emotionally, and financially. She brings home about $74,000 a year in retirement. So what happened was protective services referred her to the court system, and she got assigned a conservator and a guardian, which I have been having a heck of a time getting support from. My mother was very anxious and anxiety attacks and depression. And even though I'm a consumer and I let them know that my mother's been a consumer for years, they refused to give her services, to take her to the doctor, to get her any medication and counseling. So I've had to do this on my own, which took a toll on my own health. So consequently, I think that an ombudsman and a consumer affairs office would have helped at least me to be able to find the resources and support to have my mother be able to receive the counseling and services that she so desires and needs. She has told them and asked them to, one, get a divorce from this husband. They refuse to do it. She has asked to get into counseling. They refuse to do it. And it wasn't until February 10th that I had managed to get in to see the judge about this situation. And prior to, her medical doctor had referred for her to have a psychological evaluation back in April of last year. And they just did it prior to going before the judge. And she's doing much better because of the meds and counseling. But unfortunately, she's had to suffer all this time and could have been doing a lot better, and they could have saved her house. They were saying she was incompetent and the whole nine yards. Also, for myself, I'd like to say that I've been fortunate enough also to receive some respect in the community of the consumer survivors. And recently, in the past year, I've been hired as a peer support specialist with the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. It's been very beneficial to me. I've met a lot of people statewide, and we've made a lot of accomplishments. Also, the ALCMHP is supportive of the statewide Consumer Survivor Legislative Committee, which I facilitate, and I've invited Megan Cahy and Drake Eubank to be co-chairs because of their experience with the legislation and the bills. It is growing. We also invite transitional age youth and people of the dual diagnosed community. So I believe that we would be able to do a lot if we had a consumer affairs office and an ombudsman to help those like us to receive quality services and also to resolve any issues like the ones that most of us have had. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, thank you. We have 5 minutes and five people to go.
Oh, boy.
That means a minute apiece.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Wilson from Springfield, and I thank the fellow panelists and especially Senator Morissette for introducing this bill again. And my testimony this morning has changed three or four times after listening what went on before us. And basically what I want to say is that I'm here because I'm crazy, and I thank God for that. And during these times, when things are especially difficult, that's the time to make transformations. That's what's happened in my life. My primary diagnosis is stuttering. It doesn't hold me back. I'm not cured. I have recovered. And that's what is missing from our system at all levels, is the voice of recovery. The voice seeing people who have been through that. One of my advocacy roles is going to the Johnson unit twice a month with the NAMI program called In Our Own Voice, letting people there know that that's not the end, that that can be a beginning. And to have this role at the state level, just having a person there that people see who have recovered, not people like me, but people in the system who are working in the system, to see that the people that are stuck in stability and regressing and coming back and regressing, that is not the way it has to be. And that's all I'm going to say.
Thank you so much. I wish you
can find the money for this.
I know. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right. Kenneth Hetzer and Len Ray and Karen Cormack-Jones and Bob Jundeff bringing this up.
Madam Chair, while they're coming up, I particularly found Mike Adelman's testimony very convincing of need this bill. The cost of what he's gone through, both for him personally and the financial cost of the state, is huge. That one case being avoided would have paid for this bill.
Yeah. Huge.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kenneth Hetzel. That's Hetzel like pretzel.
All right.
All twisted. I'm a consumer and a survivor of the Tennessee State Mental Hospital. I moved here last July from my home of 50 years, and I chose to find peer supports here in Salem. I went to an AA meeting. There were 45 AA members there on July 4th, Saturday morning. I went to a NAMI support group, 7 o'clock Thursday. There were 3 NAMI mommies and no consumers. I went to Eugene to meet with the DBSA group there, and I've created a fine alliance with them. I've met with Mid Valley Behavioral Care Network here and worked through ROC, Recovery Outreach Community Center, with their dual diagnosis people. I find the Oregon air refreshing. Recovery is not a four-letter word here. I like reintegration. It goes further. It reintegrates people back into society. The mental health consumers are the least utilized asset in the world. We can contribute. We do not cost anything. I was a public accountant for 20 years before my last breakdown. I want to be a profit center. I've never applied for disability. I take no medication. I want nothing from you. I come to offer my help to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Karen Cormack-Jones. I live here in Salem, and I, of course, am here in support of this bill. I'm here because of what happened to my 9-year-old son in 2003. We have a lot of young people today, so maybe they can relate to this. That year, he became constantly nauseated. He was vomiting and losing weight. And while we waited 4 months to see the pediatric gastroenterologist at OHSU, his pediatrician referred him to a psychologist to cover all the bases because, you know, sometimes illness is all in your head. So what happened was, I don't really want to make this part of the public record, but the psychologist within the large HMO violated at least 15 Oregon laws and rules regarding psychologists and at least 20 APA ethics principles and standards. But my complaint to the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners was dismissed. Ted got better. We saw 22 doctors over 2 years, including a trip to the Mayo Clinic, so he's okay. He has problems with his immune system, bacterial infection in his stomach. He has many food allergies, and we're not sure what triggered it, if it was environmental or a combination of bad genes. But he's better, and he doesn't feel nauseated anymore. I got mad that my complaint was dismissed, so I did some research, and the only way you can find out how the health boards and the mental health boards are doing is to look at their disciplinary action rates. And I found that the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners had, between 2000 and 2004, a less than 5% rate, so they are dismissing 95% of their consumer complaints, which is pretty amazing. The other boards, the therapists, counselors, psychiatrists, which are overseen by the medical board, also have low rates of disciplinary action compared with other boards. So
I'm just here to say that a lot of damage can occur behind these closed doors, and a lot of secret deals are apparently being made, because if between 2000 and 2004 there were almost 300 complaints and only 13 resulted in any kind of disciplinary action. In 2005, they had a 5% rate again. I met with Aaron Kelly Seal of the governor's office in 2006, January, February, and oddly enough, in 2006, the rate went up to 25%. Is that because I met with Aaron Kelly Seal? I don't know. It's all behind closed doors and very secretive. And I think people who are given the stigma of having a mental health problem should not be swept under the rug. Their concern should not be, it's okay. Don't do it again, as opposed to another board that might take the complaint more seriously, such as the other health boards. I've given you some data in my attachments on the other health boards and the comparables. So thank you very much.
And thank you. And we are looking at our professional boards that oversee professionals. And so we need to hear stories from you so that we know how to correct these things. So
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair.
It would be helpful to hear those stories from an ombuds person who could cut through the red tape and get to the bottom of it. And that's what we're hearing today, is there is nowhere that they can really go to someone who has the authority to find out what the problem is. And that's why we're here.
Chair Moniz Anderson, Senator Morissette, thank you for that point. We had to hire an attorney, and I had to make a big stink, and it's real hard for me to make a big stink because I always want things to go smoothly, but here's my son, and that shouldn't have happened to him. And
thank you very much. All right. And Bob Junda.
Chair Moniz Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Len Ray, and I'm the administrator for Adult Mental Health Services for Addictions and Mental Health, and my testimony will be very short today. The Addictions and Mental Health Division, of course, supports and encourages self-determination of persons with a mental illness. AMH supports peer-directed services, and as a result, the provisions of this bill are consistent with our division's recovery and trauma policies. We are supportive of the policy in this bill. However, there is a fiscal impact that is not included in the governor's recommended budget. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob Tundef. And Mike, I saw Mike Sherlowitz. I can't pronounce or read the last name. Mike somebody.
Shirtcliffe. He's not here at the moment.
So, Bob, you're taking us home. I think we've gotten everyone to testify.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, and shadows, I will be brief. I'm very honored, actually, to be here today to support Senate Bill 368 and to have been acknowledged as an honorary consumer by earlier testimony. I think it makes, I don't have to say it, I think it makes absolute sense that people who are the focus of a service should have a strong voice in how that service is delivered. The whole purpose of the service is to help people in their recovery. I understand the fiscal problems that you face. However, I also know that this committee and others in the legislature are looking at reform of how mental health services are delivered. I think it's very important to keep in mind a strong consumer involvement component of any type of system that you're looking at putting together. As we know, there's so many other factors involved in terms of finances and the delivery system, and it's just absolutely essential that the consumer voice be heard at all levels of that policy making. And as I noted in my testimony, my written testimony, on the federal level and on many states, there's a strong component of consumer involvement that's built into our systems that give the assurance that when we're looking at how mental health services are delivered, that we're listening to the people who receive the services, their family members, and those affected by the services. So I urge you to give this bill its full consideration and to remember the principles that underlie it, because they should inform everything we do in the mental health system.
Thank you, Bob, so much. All right, with no further comments, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 368, and we are adjourned.